Tonight's topic is the search for our lost legacy. We'll learn something about the mysterious treasures of man's past. You've probably read the book by von Däniken. Maybe we'll be hearing about some of the similar themes in tonight's talk. Richard will also be discussing the Atlantean treasure vaults, the magic of the mystery schools, signals from the stars. He'll also be speaking about the mysterious second moon, and especially why new awareness is now developing on the Earth. So without further ado from me, will you welcome Richard Miller.
Good evening. I'm glad to see that everybody copied me tonight and didn't wear a tie. This last few days have been kind of warm, haven't they? We have several interesting things this evening to tell you about. And tonight we're not going to spend very much time on prepared material because I think it's always better when we can talk kind of extemporaneously about things that we are very well acquainted with. And you might say, after hearing what the talk was about tonight, that how in the world did I ever get acquainted with Atlantean time capsules and things like this? Well, really, we're going to tell you how we became aware of them, and some of the interesting things that we found out in our search. We're not going to give you a repeat of von Däniken tonight or anything like that, because I'm sure most of you have read his books and are familiar with the information that he has. Much of it is excellent and very, very good. By the way, how many of you are here tonight for the first time? Very good. Thank you. Do you mind my asking how you heard about this talk? Ah, okay, a friend. All right, good. As you're all aware, we've been very, very fortunate for some 22 years now to have been very, very active in the UFO communication studies and receiving information from our friends upstairs, as we fondly call them, via mental telepathy. Most of you are aware that we started out in much more physical means by using radio to communicate, and gradually we found out that there was a better way. Our space friends kind of sometimes refer to the radio transmissions as the hammer and chisel method. So obviously they thought there was a better way, and telepathy seemed to be it. So that's neat. By the way, in at our next talk on June the 12th, we're going to be talking about the telepathy end of it a little bit. That'll be one of the topics we're covering. And hopefully, we can explain to you a little bit about how it works, at least in our instance, because I can speak for myself without any problem. It's when I have to speak for other people that I always get my foot into it. All right. Tonight, we want to, first of all, discuss the lost legacy. And people say, well, what is that lost legacy? Down through the years, there have been, on many, many occasions, countless expressions from our friends upstairs regarding what they called vaults, in which artifacts of past great civilizations on this planet were placed. And these artifacts were being kept intact in perfect operating condition, I might mention, for a time in the Earth's future when they would be required once again on this planet. Now, obviously, if they're to be of great help to mankind in a troubled period of time coming, then they've got to be pretty well scattered around the Earth, because you just couldn't have them in one certain place. Otherwise, other people wouldn't have access to them. So, down through the years, we've had mention from time to time from our friends that there are many of these repositories, or what we referred to as a time vault, placed in various areas of the world. And each one of these contains different types of artifacts. Now, when we say artifacts, we don't mean that they've got a museum going, you know, with hammers and chisels and things like this, or saws. But there are actual working things in these repositories. There are machines of various kinds. We understand that there are aircraft, very advanced forms of aircraft available, and that there are even some of the so-called UFOs themselves intact, literally in storage. We would like to mention as well that there have been references to such places as what we're talking about in many of the world's legends. For instance, in Peru, with the Incas, there are mentions of these vaults. In the Mayan, there are mentions of them. Even over in China, there is mention of them. And we find them as well in South Africa and in the continent of Africa and over in the Middle East, that they refer to these various repositories in various legends. It takes a great deal of research to run them all down, and of course not having the time to pursue all of the scholarly background on these things, we had to rely more or less on our space friends to supply the initial information. And then when we found interested people, we would ask those people to check these things out for us to the best of their ability. And that way, we came up with various types of corroboration. But for instance, please now put yourself in my shoes for a moment, and let's go back to Detroit, Michigan, in the year 1954. As many of you remember who were here at the second talk, that's when all kinds of weird things happened to me personally, like meeting people from outer space and things like this. All right, as you'll recall, back in 1954, was during the period we were receiving radio communications. But you'll also, those of you who were here, will remember the fact that we were working in conjunction with a fellow who was an anthropologist by the name of George Hunt Williamson. And George Hunt Williamson was also very active in the saucer investigation movement. He was lecturing around the country. He had been involved with George Adamski in one of the incidents where Adamski met a Venusian out in the Mojave Desert. And Williamson was a well-known public speaker in the field of UFOlogy. Well, we met Williamson, as you'll recall, in Detroit in 54 when he came there to talk about how he and a ham radio operator who worked for the Santa Fe Railroad had communicated with flying saucers via shortwave radio. And that's, by the way, how we were able to achieve similar results. And so over a period of months in 54 and well into 55 and early 56, Williamson and I had occasion to be together quite often. We traveled extensively together. We did a lot of research together on basic information. You'll also recall that we mentioned that this fellow Williamson was a channel. Now, the difference was that Williamson was a trance medium, a trance channel. He would go into a trance in order to receive communications from space beings. And you'll recall that one evening when I was sitting there listening to him give a long discourse, how I fell asleep and woke up saying the same thing he had been saying at the other end of the room. You remember that, I think. Banged my head on the piano and all of those crazy things that happen to people when you get into weird experiences. Okay. Williamson, as a result of our communications contacts via radio and via light beam equipment, prior to our coming out here to the West Coast, decided that he would see if he could get some information, being an anthropologist, on some of these repositories that the Atlanteans supposedly left. In other words, before Atlantis was evacuated, when certain of their people saw the handwriting on the wall, so to speak, many of their scientific achievements were placed in these safe places to be stored for a future time. You're aware of how we also have what we call time vaults or time capsules, where we bury things hoping they'll be dug up by somebody hundreds of years from now. Apparently, the Atlanteans weren't any different. The only difference is that they did have a degree of cooperation with our space friends, particularly the ones that were being evacuated, and our space friends helped them in many instances choose the sites for these things, because obviously our space friends were possessed of information and knowledge about coming changes of a geographical nature on this planet that would make certain sites more untenable than others as far as a safe place to keep things buried. Obviously, if the area was going to be flooded or be underwater as a result of some natural phenomena that was occurring, or earthquakes and so forth, these sites had to be chosen very carefully. You certainly didn't want, you know, what you had stored wet with the water or something, or you wouldn't want a vault to crack open due to an earthquake and expose its contents. So a lot of help was given to the Atlanteans in preparing for these places by our friends upstairs. Now, apparently that knowledge is recorded somewhere, let's say, in the annals of history for our space friends, because even in recent times they mention them frequently. So apparently the information has been passed along, let's say from generation to generation, upstairs, and these people know where these vaults are. The current generation, let's say, do. Well, we, of course, were not possessed at that time of any of this other than the references, and so we decided we would find out all we could. So one evening, Williamson was in communication via his method, and a particular individual started telling him about, we had asked a question regarding the Atlantean time vaults. And he said, well, there is one in Arizona, not very far from where your parents live, Mr. Williamson. Well, this was startling. And remember, Williamson was in trance and unaware of what he was saying. He didn't know what was said through him until we played the tape back afterwards for him. So when he heard this afterwards, he was quite surprised. So that evening, rather than just having one session, you might say, or a communications attempt, as soon as we heard the original tape, we formed a whole series of questions, and Rick went back into trance. Rick is his nickname. We called him Rick Williamson, to see if we could get some further answers on where in Arizona this place was. Well, they came back and they gave us the names of several streams and creeks, believe it or not. And, of course, we hadn't heard of them. He hadn't heard of them. We didn't know the name of a stream or a creek in Arizona, living in Michigan and never having been out this way. So it was all very, very fascinating, and they pinpointed the area for us by just giving us the names of the streams and creeks and a rough description of the area. Well, days later, through the use of maps and so forth, and several phone calls to Arizona, we were able to discover the area in question. But our space friends, speaking through Williamson, said there were some other interesting things to be observed. They said, we would prefer you to arrive, just as if they knew we were going, at the location on the 9th of the month when the moon is full. We said, fine. Of course, this sent us searching into the calendars and almanacs to find out when the moon was going to be full on the 9th of the month. So, as I recall, there really wasn't any occasion within the near future, not within several years anyway, of when that occurrence was going to happen. So we went back at them still again and said, we're sorry, we just can't find that particular time slot. Will another do instead? And so they said, yes, you can, if you will visit the area in January of 1955, we will activate this place for you in such a way that you know you're in the right place. We said, great, now what do we have to do? Well, they gave us certain things like there was to be a certain number of people in the party that went to this area. It sounded very mysterious and intriguing, you know, and of course back in those days, we used to have an old saying, we were all fat, dumb, and happy, see. So we had a lot of fun, you know, planning this big expedition to Arizona. And they dropped the bombshell, or the other shoe, somewhere along the line in these communications, because these lasted for several weeks, obviously. And they said, oh, by the way, you can stop at a certain place in Colorado on the way there and check that out as well. So now we knew that there was one in Colorado and there was one in Arizona. So we said, are there any more of them? And they said, oh, yes, there are countless numbers of them. And they rattled off several other locations, some here in the United States and some in other countries. And we said, well, now, this is all fine and good, but, and please understand, we were kind of doubters, too, back in those days. And we were kind of hard to be sold some of this information, because, you know, trance mediums, you don't know who is really doing the communicating. They can say they're anybody. And so we didn't want to have games played on us. First of all, it's expensive to travel all the way from Michigan to Arizona. And we decided that if we were going to do it, we were really going to do it up brown. We were going to go out there with all kinds of equipment and check out the sites. You know, we were going to monitor everything we could. We were going to take radio equipment, Geiger counters, magnetometers, you name it. You know, we were going to really go prepared. And metal locators, the whole bit. You know, literally a truckload of equipment going out with us. And of course, since we had to beg, borrow, or steal the equipment from somebody, none of us could afford to go out and buy this neat stuff, it meant that we were really going to a great inconvenience to make this journey out there. The only thing is that Williamson had to go out there anyway, so his fare was paid, but the rest of us were all paying for this out of our own pockets. And it looked like it was going to be at least a month's endeavor, checking out these various sites, and that was going to cost quite a bit of money. Those of you who travel know what we're talking about, expenses and everything else while you're on the road. Okay. This all led on and on and on, and we were able to track down the information that they gave us. And we found out where these places were. We found the one in Colorado. We also located that area. We located the one in Arizona, as I mentioned to you. And we asked them, well, about that time is when I decided I was going to get out of our business that I was in Detroit and move out to the West Coast, because that's where all the action was. You know, all the UFOs were flying up and down the San Andreas Fault at 9 o'clock every night. All you had to do was read the newspaper. And every night somebody claimed they saw a UFO somewhere along the San Andreas Fault. And then there was this fellow Adamski who was out there for 50 cents. You could look through his telescope and see one every night of the week. And if you didn't believe that, he'd show you a picture he'd taken of one through his telescope. So it sounded like everything was happening in California. And we said, well, look, we're not going to be stuck back here in Michigan, away from where everything is going on. So let's go out to California. And on the way there, in order to help defray the expenses, we'll just stop at these places and check them out. And if it takes us a month en route to get to California, so what? At least we're only making one move or one trip rather than going out here for that specially and then having to go back to Michigan and move everything back out again. So that's how we arranged it. So in the middle of December, we left Detroit and headed for California. with stops in Colorado and elsewhere along the way to check out some of these various locations. So we stopped in Colorado, we stopped in Arizona, we stopped in New Mexico, we stopped in California prior to reaching Los Angeles to check out various locales that they had mentioned. Okay, as I said, in most cases, the information had been specific only in the names of certain reference marks, like streams or creeks or various landmarks. They didn't say which town it was near, how far it was from the town, in what direction, whether or not there were any roads in the area. We had to do all of this legwork on our own to find out where they were. We went through the Coast and Geodetic Survey, and we obtained maps of these different areas, and of course, we stayed there and looked the maps over in their offices first before we bought them, to make sure that such and such a landmark really was on the map. All right, and in most every case, we found they were. Apparently, these people, whoever they were that were talking through Williamson, knew what they were talking about. So we made the trip. By the way, are you finding this interesting tonight? This is really a true story. It really happened. That's why I can sit here and tell it to you. And it's just as clear in my mind as if it had happened yesterday. We drove out very leisurely, stopped along the way many times, and finally we arrived in Colorado. And the first town we went to there to check something out was called a town called Durango. Now, right outside of Durango, Colorado, there is a national monument called Mesa Verde National Park. And our space friends had indicated that Mesa Verde was not one of the repositories, but was one of their landing sites that they had used on occasion. Well, Rick, being an anthropologist, checked through from his sources in the educational world, and he got hold of the legends of the Indians that lived in the Mesa Verde area. And on the way out, he was reading books as I was driving and so forth. And he said, "Richard, we have something here." He said, "There's a curious legend. And the Indians at Mesa Verde," and this was sometime we were back in Nebraska someplace driving. He said, "The Indians claim that they built a special temple to the sun and to the gods who would come visit them at Mesa Verde." So we said, fine, when we get to Mesa Verde, we'll be sure and look at this so-called Sun Temple. So we came over the mountains through Denver and across Wolf Creek Pass and through that country up there, and we dropped down to Durango. And I remember one thing, the pass that we came through was 11,000 feet and the car was very sluggish. So those are just little interesting sidelights you remember as you're repeating these stories. You know, you sit there with your foot clear to the floorboard and the car's doing 40 miles an hour. The gas gauge is just going like this. So anyway, we got terrible mileage on that leg of the trip. What happened is we got to Mesa Verde in the middle of the afternoon, and if you've ever been there, any of you, it's quite a drive from the town down below up to this tremendous plateau which seems like thousands of feet on the side of this mountain. And we got up there, and of course in December it was cold. We had come through an awful lot of snow in Colorado. And there was snow on the ground up there as well. I think the altitude is, I don't know how many thousands, but it's up there. So it was very cold, the wind was blowing, we got out of our nice warm automobile, and we froze to death instantly on the spot. We meandered around through the ruins, and we finally, by following the trails, and we stopped and got a guidebook from the Forest Service or the Park Service there, and sure enough, there was a sun temple listed. So we drove on out to where this sun temple was, and we stopped and got out of the car again and looked. And at these different ruins that they have there, and they have some beautiful cliff dwellings that are down in the side canyons and so forth, but this sun temple was on the end of a mesa, very, very high, and quite a ways away from the other ruins. We got out of the car, and we walked over, and they had something about like this podium, which is a standard that gives you a little rundown on what the ruin is all about, and this type of thing. So we stood there and flipped up the cover on it so we could read it. And it was talking about the Indians, and it mentioned this particular legend that Rick had discovered in this one book about how the gods used to come and visit the Indians. And they said, if you will look into the ruin, you will notice that there are two huge rings in the center of this ruin. Now, the rings, to me, being an electronics man, looked to me like a ring magnet. If any of you know what ring magnets are. Because they were circular, about 10 or 12 feet in diameter, there was a gap right in the middle, about, well, not any wider than that. Two people couldn't have walked through it at the same time. And the rings were built rather strangely in that where the gap was that you could walk into these rings inside this compound, the rock work was very low, like maybe only 6 or 7 inches off the ground. And then as the ring went on around its circumference on either side, the rock work was higher and higher and higher until it was highest at the very back of the ring. So it was kind of a strange shaped round ring with this opening in the center. And there were two of these inside the compound or the temple. We read a little bit further on the bulletin board there. And they said that, and this was the thing that caught our eye, that the gods, when they would visit the Indians, insisted that they both meet unarmed. Therefore, the reason for the two rings inside this compound. The Indians would store all of their bows and arrows and spears in this one ring. And the gods, when they visited, would store their weapons of lightning in the other ring. Very interesting. And of course, there was a large, broad, flat area which could have housed 3 or 4 beautiful-sized spaceships right next to this temple. Something else was very interesting. They had a built-in system at this particular temple for determining exactly when the vernal equinox occurred, and this is when the meetings between the gods and the Indians took place, was at the time of the vernal equinox. So we found all of this very interesting. We took pictures of the site and so forth like this. But really there wasn't anything else to do, and we were freezing to death. So we jumped back in the car, and away we went. We said, we're going to head for sunny Arizona. Along the way, going down to Arizona, we had to drop into New Mexico for a ways. We had to get down onto Highway 66. Some of you who travel across the country know where that is. Okay, we came into a town called Shiprock, New Mexico, and eventually we ended up in Albuquerque, and we were driving along Route 66. And in those days, they were trying to upgrade the highway. Part of Route 66 was made out of old paving brick. And part of it was, you know, modern concrete. And we happened to be on the stretch that was all paving bricks. You know, it was like driving on cobblestones, really. It was a bad stretch of road, in terrible shape. So we were driving along, and all of a sudden, our friends said, stop the car. Just a telepathic message, right out of the blue. So we pulled over to the side of the road, and they said, remember where this exit road on your left is. And we looked over, and sure enough, there was a little dirt road on the left that led out into the middle of nowhere. Now, we were 3 or 4 miles outside of a little small town. And they said, remember the road well. I said, fine. Said, is there something there? And they said, yes, there is something there. But now is not the time for you to look into this place. But remember it. Okay. So we will tell you when to check it out. Fine. So we started the car again, and off we went. Drove into Gallup, and then across to Flagstaff, and then down to this town in Arizona where Williamson's parents lived, a town called Prescott. Well, Prescott is at 5,000 feet, too, and it was cold in Prescott. It wasn't warm, sunny Arizona that I'd heard about. We'd seen an awful lot of snow, particularly up around the Flagstaff area, and then down into Prescott. And the first night I spent in Prescott was with both feet propped up in front of a roaring log fire in a big stone fireplace, because it was really cold out. I think it was about 12 above zero that night, middle of December. Okay, the next day, we drove to this location that our friends had told us all about back in Detroit. And we took along, we had phoned ahead, we had other people meet us there in Prescott, so that there were, I think, five of us in all who went out to this location. And, of course, we had all of this equipment with us. Now, this location is quite a ways from Prescott, so it took us a couple of hours at least to drive there. When we got there, we were very surprised. We had found on the maps exactly where they were talking about. I'm not going to identify the location for you, not at this particular time. I'm just going to tell you that it is there. We did a couple of interesting things. We found out, first of all, that the Indians had a strange legend about this place. At one time, this was Apache country. And today, of course, the Apaches have been moved out of the area and are over on a reservation 60 or 70 miles away from here, in this place. So we decided we wanted to find out all we possibly could about the legends first. And it was very strange. Rick, being, again, an anthropologist and well-known in this area, had some friends among both the Hopi, the Navajo, and the Apache tribes. And so he had finagled an introduction to talk with one of the old Apache chiefs. So we drove that day, after we scouted the main area and saw that it was there, we drove over to the Apache Reservation, which is over in northeastern Arizona, in the White Mountain country. And we talked to these Apaches. It was the first time I'd ever met a real live Indian. So it was a real experience for me. I was enthralled. And this fellow was a typical Indian, you know, the old wrinkled up face, very old. You know, if he was 90, he was 110. And he told us an interesting story. He said many, many years ago, the Apaches, and before them other tribes of Indians, had been given a sacred trust by their gods to protect this area that we had been to earlier that day. And of course, they felt very, very bad when the government moved them out of that area and put them on this reservation, because then they could no longer protect the area. It was held sacred by them. And so we asked, well, why was it considered sacred to you? And they said, it was very strange, but at night, at certain times of the year, when the moon was full, that pyramid-shaped lights would fly very slowly down along this particular creek and stop in front of this particular area and hover. And strange beams of light would radiate out from these pyramid-shaped lights. And so the Apaches, in their own way, said it is the sun god protecting a treasure, the sun god's treasure, and that's how they referred to it, the sun god's treasure. They didn't know what it was. They just knew it was a treasure of some kind. No Apache had ever seen it. And they knew the place was sacred. Okay, we got the story. He also said something else that we had heard about in Detroit, through Williamson again. This space being, who had talked with Williamson and described this place to us and how to find it, had mentioned that there were, inside of this place, there were 12 cylinders Inside of these cylinders were 144 tablets, metal tablets. And on these metal tablets were engraved much information and much knowledge. And these tablets were made of a very special metal that was literally imperishable. All right. We didn't say any of this or mention any of this to this Apache chief. But he mentioned the fact that one of their religious artifacts was a strange metal tablet with strange characters engraved on it. And it was kind of golden in color. And I said, well, do you have it? Could we see it? And they said, no, it has been stolen from us. When was it stolen? 6 months ago. Do you have any idea where it went? No. Well, aren't you worried about it? Did you report it to the police? No. They haven't reported it to the police. Why haven't you reported it? Certainly anything that valuable, you know, and Rick, his scientific curiosity was really boiling at this point. He said, you know, an incalculable find, an archaeological find, when you let this thing slip through your fingers, it was stolen, you didn't report it. And he said, no. Why? He said, it will come back. It'll come back to us. I said, well, how do you know that? He said, it has disappeared before and always turned up again. Well, what do? You don't argue with an old Apache. You just accept what he says and you thank him for it. So we decided that this was neat. Now we had pyramidal lights, which sounded strangely like UFOs to us. We had the fact that it was a sacred area protected by the Apaches and by other Indians before the Apaches as a sacred spot. And usually, you know, one Indian tribe does not adopt another Indian tribe's sacred spot, let alone protect it. So this was strange. That was an odd coincidence. The mention of this metal tablet, the same as what we had heard about back in Detroit. Oh, and by the way, the area that we were supposed to check out was called Telus. T-E-A-L-U-S. Telus. And, strangely enough, the metal that these tablets were made out of, these engraved tablets, was telonium. T-E-L-O-N-I-U-M. Well, we looked that up, and there isn't any such metal. So it must be something we don't know about. At least we don't show it in our composition of metals, anything by that name. All right. We thought, well, that's interesting. Telus telonium. It kind of rings a bell. We did some other research, and we found out that parts of Arizona and New Mexico and part of Southern California was once an Atlantean province called Telus. Very strange. That was the Atlantean name for the area, one of their provinces, Telus. So now we knew where the connection was. Okay, we went back to this place the following day. We set up radio equipment. We had jeeps and so forth with two-way radio equipment. And the first thing we noticed, and this was an absolute scientific mind-blower to us, was that there was a strange radio signal emanating from this area, from the heart of the area. We drove out to see how far it was, and we also had direction-finding equipment. We found out that the signal ended abruptly 5 miles away from the area. No matter which way we went, it ended abruptly at 5 miles. Now, radio signals don't do that. But this radio signal did. In fact, it was so pronounced, the shutoff, that carrying a battery-operated shortwave radio, you could get right out to 4 miles and 99 hundredths, and you had the signal. You could take one step beyond it, and the signal was gone, completely gone. Take one step back, and the signal was there. We tried this in the jeeps, driving back and forth. signal be right there and then cut off. Radio signals don't do this. So we were amazed. We went into the area still further, and we took Geiger counter readings. And we noticed there was a much higher background radiation count in the area than is considered normal. Now, of course, as you recall, in 55, people were very interested in the fallout. So it wasn't hard to find out what the background count was in 1955. So we found out what it was, and the count in this area was much higher than average. And yet, this area is not heavily mineralized. And so unless some fallout from one of our atomic tests had just happened to pass over the area about that time, there was no explanation as to why the area should have a higher background count than normal. Okay, the best part of the story is still to come. Our friends had said to be there at night, and they would activate this repository. Well, we didn't have any idea what in the world they meant by activate it. We didn't know if they were going to open it, you know, let us go in, or what was going to happen. Well, we did all the probing we could in the daylight hours. We found a way to get into this place where we could drive most of the way. But this is an area where there are some very severe cliffs, and the travel, particularly at night, was very hazardous. You couldn't have made it in there without a Jeep. I mean, driving across the country. It also turned out that we actually had to have ropes to tie ourselves together because of some very narrow ledges that had to be traversed, plus hauling along all the equipment that we had. We went out from where this cliff was. There was a creek, the one they had mentioned, right at the foot of this cliff, 300 feet down. And across from this cliff, there was a big open meadow with a lot of scrub, desert brush in there. And they had said that we were to watch the cliffs. So the only way we could watch the cliff was to get out in the middle of the meadow, which means we had to wade the stream or the creek. So during the daylight hours, we had gone down and figured out how to get across the stream, you know, where the stepping stones were and things like this, so we could get out into the meadow. We went out that night, all of us again, and we didn't know what to look for. We had no idea what kind of a sign they were going to give us. So we sat there and we waited and we waited. Now remember, this was in January, and it was cold. The elevation there is about 3,000, 4,000 feet. You notice I keep mentioning how cold it was in Arizona at that time? I don't think I got warmed up over there at all, not until years later. Had to move to Phoenix in order to get warm. In any event, we were all out there standing around, stomping our feet, trying to keep warm, and not knowing what in the world to look for or what was going to happen. And after an hour, you know, it gets to be pretty old. You know, when you're shivering and you're cold. We had taken some thermoses of hot coffee and things like that along, but those went down pretty fast. So we were nearing the end of the coffee, and of course that's disaster. So we said, Rick, why don't you get back in touch with them and find out how long we're going to have to wait here. Maybe we've got time to drive back into town and get the thermoses refilled. You know, if it's not going to happen for another hour or two, let's find out at least. So he did. He went back into trance. He sat down on the ground. And they said, within 10 minutes, we will activate the depository for you. Fine. What are we to look for? Just watch for a light. Great. Any particular area? They didn't say. Okay. Within 10 minutes, you said. Right. In 10 minutes. Great. We're out in the middle of the tulies. There's nobody around us. It's pitch black. Colder than you know what. And we're supposed to watch for a light. We formed a circle. All of us. Facing outwards, so we could cover all 360 degrees, the five of us. That way we could be looking in every direction at once, and that way we wouldn't miss it wherever it happened. And Rick stayed in trance in the middle of this circle. And so we were talking to him, and he was, apparently these people were relaying, or through him, and they could hear our questioning him. And we arranged ourselves in a circle, and we kept looking for this light, and we looked at our watches, and sure enough, here's 10 minutes. And they said, all right, look now at the cliffs. Finally told us. And we did. We all turned and looked at these cliffs. Now, you'd have to see a picture of this, and I'll try and give you just some idea how big a cliff we're talking about. It's at least a half a mile long and 300 to 400 feet high. So it's a pretty big cliff. That cliff suddenly started glowing with a very strange bluish light. And the funny part about it was, is that this light was not coming from the outside, like somebody shining a light on the face of the cliffs. It was as if the cliffs were glowing internally. Because looking at the cliffs, we could see the fissures in the rock, where the various strata and layers of rock were. It was almost like we were looking at an X-ray of the cliff, and the cliffs were glowing with a strange blue light, bluish white, very dim at first, and the longer